thought I told you never to interrupt me while I'm working.
Money point seven.
From the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, welcome to Aspect Radio. I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. Today we'll take a moment to tell you which legendary filmmakers have simply lost their fastball, so to speak. But first, yesterday saw the wide release of two movies, both of which opened here in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16. One was the highly anticipated big-budget animated sequel Shrek Forever After. But speaking for Ben and myself, I believe we were probably both more interested, against all odds, in MacGruber, the big screen adaptation of the recurring Saturday Night Live sketch. Now, these sketches are all approximately 30 seconds of Will Forte playing the MacGyver parody MacGruber, along with co-star Kristen Wiig, and usually that week's guest host, attempting to defuse a bomb or some explosive and failing, always dying at the end of the sketches. So there were some questions when this movie was announced as to how such a skit that always ended with its main characters exploding would translate to the big screen, not to mention the frequently terrible track record of Saturday Night Live sketches translating to film, with such notable flops as Coneheads, The Ladies' Man, Superstar, and It's Pat behind them. Well, we have our answer now. So Ben, does MacGruber break the trend of these SNL movies of late, or should it have stayed in 30-second increments?
Well, first of all, let me say that I like Coneheads.
Okay.
Now that that's out of the way, I think it works as a feature-length film, and the catalyst for that is the fact that I found out last night, and I kind of knew before, Will Forte is an absolute monster.
Yeah.
And look, as a fan of SNL, I've been familiar with Forte's sort of absurdist brand of humor, and I was even on board with the Brothers Solomon, mostly. I've always understood at that moment when somebody tells me they just don't get or just don't like Forte's comedy, which, in its over-the-top and sort of highly articulated execution, it's very unusual. It turns people off to a point where their eyes sort of roll back in their heads when a MacGruber theme song kicks in on SNL. You've always had that feeling that Forte is just this incredible talent whose energy and sort of strange creativity has yet to be properly bottled by Lorne Michaels and SNL and really pulled off on a popular network television show. I think he's been allowed to cut loose, I think he's never been allowed to really cut loose and have full reign behind what he's putting on screen. And I think if you give a guy like him a feature film with an R rating, and we finally have that with this raw Will Forte experience in MacGruber, and I gotta say, I absolutely loved it.
Wow. I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very funny. You're right, though, that this is certainly Will Forte unrestrained. And I gotta give a lot of the credit, not only to him, but to director Yorma Taccone, who is probably most noteworthy for being a third of the Lonely Island comedy team responsible for the digital shorts on Saturday Night Live and Hot Rod, which is, I think, underrated and awesome and just terrifically funny. But there's so much about this movie that works, like I said, against all odds. It's just a fun, just completely crazy experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really good filthy comedy in a time that we haven't had a lot of good filthy comedies lately.
Yeah, and you've got to think at this point that Forte is still relatively unknown to the public, yet he has this ferocious swagger for almost an hour and a half of material. I think he's really got the right blend of one-liners, profanity, excessive profanity, physical humor, and just all-out silliness that never really tries to fully distract us from what's actually a compelling, if overly simple, narrative. And really, at no point did I ever get tired of what could have been another stretched-out, mediocre SNL sketch that never really deserved a feature film. I think a lot of people felt that way when they saw or when they heard that MacGruber was being given the feature film treatment. I think the movie's pace, although intentionally rushed as a jab at the typical Hollywood action fare, I think it's perfect for this rapid-fire, joke-per-second format that actually manages to blend some fun action set pieces in it from time to time. And as you said, director Jorma Taccone, who I think should be a cast member on SNL, he, Forte, and co-writer John Solomon, they never lose sight of why the film exists at all, which is to tell jokes. And rarely did anything actually fall flat, thanks mostly to Forte's tour de force performance.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think what helps the movie is that it's not just an hour and a half of, like, MacGruber being trapped in small rooms with bombs, you know, which I guess was the worry, but it is, it goes the extra mile and is a full-on parody of the 80s action movie, mm-hmm. which is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So you have these great gags involving, I mean, I kind of feel like embarrassed admitting this because it got me every time, but the gags involving MacGruber's taste in music,
mm-hmm.
Which should have been obvious, but they were just so funny to me.
Or how he listens to that music.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, every time that got me. And it just happened over and over again, and it got me every time. But you've got all these great 80s references, even in the casting of Val Kilmer as the villain, making a return to comedy. And, you know, everybody who's seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang from 5 years ago knows this, but this guy needs to be cast in more comedies.
Yeah, and I'm kind of glad to see this sort of swollen version of Val Kilmer back on screen, you know, at all, much less in a comedy. You know, there are several moments when it really felt like this was the guy from Top Secret or from
right.
Real Genius. He was almost back in his wheelhouse, and what they needed from Kilmer was for him to at least halfway believe in what they were up to, and I think he's on board 100%. And, you know, looking back, another co-star in this movie, Ryan Phillippe, he actually hosted Saturday Night Live recently, and you have to figure that had everything to do with his involvement with MacGruber and now having a relationship with Will Forte and Jorma Taccone and probably Lorne Michaels. And I always wondered if they really wanted to have somebody from MacGruber host SNL, why not Val Kilmer? I don't know. I think he hosted one time back in the early 2000s. But I'm still not really sure why they went with Ryan Phillippe for that or for this movie as this sort of straight man sidekick role where he's given absolutely nothing to do other than react to MacGruber and deliver a few punchlines you wouldn't expect him to. I think his big physical gag towards the end didn't really do anything for me, at least not nearly as much as it did the first time we see another character do it earlier in the movie. And I've never really been a fan of Ryan Phillippe in general, but I think that the movie could have benefited from somebody who actually has some comedic chops and knows how to time these kinds of jokes and let Will Forte do his thing. And I don't think Phillippe distracts us from what Forte is up to. I think he's just kind of an unstoppable force. I just might have cast somebody differently.
I thought he was a little stiff at the beginning, but as the movie went on, I think he caught it. I think he picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of fireside chat that he and MacGruber have, which gets really dark there for a little while and goes places that I would not have expected, but just cracked me up. He was good in that. His reaction to that is pretty priceless, and then the ensuing action scene there is pretty awesome. And I think that, like, from that point on in the movie, he's really strong. I don't think he's, you know, as much of an asset to the movie, say Val Kilmer, but or even Powers Booth as the general, just because his presence
mm-hmm.
is always nice. But yeah. he's all right.
Yeah, and another person that we haven't even talked about yet is Kristen Wiig, and I think that we kind of have this slightly toned down version of her. And, you know, I'd much rather have somebody with her dynamic alongside Forte instead of some young, attractive Hollywood actress with no experience in a comedy, which they could have easily cast in this film to maybe boost more ticket sales. I think that there are enough Wiggisms to sort of satisfy her fans and other SNL fans, but she seems to sort of just stand aside and let Forte do his thing. And something that I've noticed with Kristen Wiig in movies, and I think that you could probably exclude Knocked Up from this, because I think that's as much of Wiig just in terms of her abilities that you get. That's just her mm-hmm. at her best. I think that in films, she's really showing a lot of restraint. you see, like I said, this very toned-down version of what Wig is capable of. If you look at this, the brother Solomon, she's not really funny in that movie, and even Whippet, she's never really funny in that movie either. She's just sort of there delivering her lines.
She's very good in
Whippet. Yeah, she's an appealing actress. She always is. I mean, you're always interested in what Kristen Wiig's up to, but she's never really, other than Knocked Up, I think, been as hilarious as we know she can be. But what did you think of her in this movie?
Yeah, I think you're spot on in saying that she's sort of toned down. She also has some of the same sort of manic energy, I suppose, in Adventureland, playing off Bill Hader. But you're right in that all of her film appearances so far have not really channeled the manic energy that we know she's capable of from Saturday Night Live. Is that a bad thing? I think that it could have been distracting if she was trying to, you know, do that in this movie with Will Forte just chewing up scenery left and right and just running amok. So I think that in this movie, her toned-down presence was necessary. I'd like to see her actually anchor a film. And you know, I think that there's something in the works that she's written a film that she's going to star in, that Judd Apatow is producing, if I'm not mistaken. So that'll be nice to see her finally take the lead, because I think that's when we're going to see her, much like Will Forte, go nuts.
I just hope it's not a Gilly movie.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yeah.
I
could do without Gilly.
I think this movie makes you wonder what, you know, every time a new SNL adaptation comes out, it makes you wonder what character could work next. And, you know, I doubt many of us thought that MacGruber would work as a feature-length film, just like you said, because of how short those segments were each week. You just had 3 30-second clips. And they were all hilarious to me, but I think that they are kind of an acquired taste, which I think Will Forte is.
Right.
But, you know, do you look at it now and say, well, maybe this small character who's only been in a few sketches would actually make a better film character, or would be a better subject for a feature-length film than, say, you know, recurring character that's on now? And I'm trying to think of some of the recurring characters that they might try to translate on a big screen. I mean, I certainly would not want to see a What Up With That movie, or, you know, I would rather see maybe a Mambo Italiano, I think is what it, Mondo, Vinny Videcci, Bill Hader's character. Yeah. That would be hilarious.
Just more Bill Hader in general.
But in that also kind of surprised me is that there are only 2 Saturday Night Live active cast members in this movie.
And a whole bunch of professional wrestlers.
Yeah, that was good. I really kind of liked that. Yeah. You know, I recognized 4 of them, and I thought it was hilarious. And really, the point of their being there, which is this huge punchline, I thought that was pulled off very well. And Will Ferrell's reaction to that punchline is one of the better comedy set pieces of the movie.
Yep.
And while this movie obviously relies on its jokes set against these sort of cheap sets and even cheaper special effects, which I think is incredibly deliberate, I will say that Yorma Taconi, he really did all he could to make the film look good, which I think it really does for the most part.
And you know, going back to what you were saying a moment ago about giving other recurring characters on Saturday Night Live film adaptations, I would actually look at it and just give the creative forces, like particularly the Lonely Island guys, more opportunities to make film. Because with Hot Rod and now with MacGruber, they've turned out, I don't know how financially successful those movies are. I don't think Hot Rod did very well at all, and we'll see how MacGruber does, but they've turned out at least 2 creatively inspired comedies, and they'll knock it out of the park eventually, I'm sure, financially, into something that connects with a public, or maybe they won't, you know, because their humor, to be fair, is a bit esoteric, and like you said, an acquired taste. But I eagerly anticipate what these guys do next.
Yeah, and I laughed out loud throughout the entire movie. It wasn't just chuckling, it wasn't smirking or anything. There are tons of laugh out loud moments, and I would watch this movie again. I think that this is probably going to be fairly popular on DVD, especially among college kids. Because, I mean, it's just laced with profanity that's actually funny, and that's just what, you know, college kids eat up, and it's got so many quotable lines, and I think Forte was really going for that. He's like, I'm gonna make this one of the more quotable movies with just these ridiculous statements that MacGruber makes.
Not anything we could say on the radio.
Yeah, we couldn't, unfortunately. I wish we could, and I wish we could make some stingers or something like that, but we can't. We got to get the bleep machine ready.
Not at all.
But, I mean, Corey, just to kind of close, have you kind of looked back on the SNL adaptation, the list of movies that have been made, and ranked this yet? Or, I mean, can you just kind of say, because it seems like you've had a favorable reaction to it, that it's up there?
It's up there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you'd count Hot Rod as that's not an adaptation of any SNL property.
That's more in the family of Brother Solomon.
Just people who are involved.
Right.
But as far as adaptations of SNL sketches, this has got to be up there, because I can't really think of anything else that...
Well, as I was watching it, I kept thinking, is this as good as Wayne's World, which I think is one of the better SNL adaptations. Maybe not the best. I mean, I think a lot of people think of the Blues Brothers as being maybe the best SNL adaptation. Again, I'm a big Coneheads fan, but I think that might just be me. But I think it is right up there with those movies, just based on its comedic merit alone. And I think it works as a movie. And it's really kind of a comforting moment when... you finally get a sort of homage to the actual MacGruber sketch towards the end of the movie,
yeah.
And you're kind of waiting for that to come. And one of the line that sort of triggers that is delivered by Kristen Wiig. But either way, we will take a break. The film is playing nationwide, and it is in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16. So do stick around. This is Aspect Radio. We're going to hit you with some Vampire Weekend. When we come back, we're actually going to be joined by Ben Stark for his thoughts on the Shia LaBeouf public criticisms of a legend who helped him establish himself as an A-list leading man. So please do stick around. This is Aspect Radio.
I don't want to get paid to lose. I want to win!
Money point seven.
Welcome back to Aspect Radio. I'm Ben Flanagan, always joined by Corey Kraft, each week, 9 a.m. on Saturdays. Last week, you likely read about young actor Shia LaBeouf's recent comments on his role in Steven Spielberg's 2009 attempt to revitalize the Indiana Jones franchise. And he also said a few choice words about Steven Spielberg's general execution of the sequel, and without simply paraphrasing, Corey, why don't you just read what little Shia had to say?
Sure. So on Indiana Jones, as it relates to his upcoming sequel, Wall Street 2, Mutton Never Sleeps, he said, "I feel like I dropped the ball on the legacy that people loved and cherished. If I was going to do it twice, my career was over, so this was fight or flight for me." On where the blame lies for the creative shortcomings of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, he said, "You get to monkey swinging and things like that, and you can blame it on the writer, and you can blame it on Steven Spielberg, the director of the film. But the actor's job is to make it come alive and make it work, and I couldn't do it. So that's my fault. Simple." He's not alone in thinking that Indy 4 missed the mark. As he says, apparently Harrison Ford wasn't happy either. He says, "We," meaning himself and Harrison Ford, "had major discussions. He wasn't happy with it either. Look, the movie could have been updated. There was a reason it wasn't universally accepted." And on what he thinks Steven Spielberg's reaction is going to be when he hears about these frank words, he said, "I'll probably get a call, but he needs to hear this. I love him. I love Steven. I have a relationship with Steven that supersedes our business work. And believe me, I talk to him often enough to know that I'm not out of line. And I would never disrespect the man. I think he's a genius, and he's given me my whole life. He's done so much great work that there's no need for him to feel vulnerable about one film. But when you drop the ball, you drop the ball."
Wow.
Certainly frank words.
Yeah, that was my reaction when I read that. But there was only one opinion I really wanted to hear about this, and joining us on the phone now is our friend and frequent guest of the program, Ben Stark, who you may know by now is not only a fan of this beloved Indiana Jones franchise, as we all certainly are, but even a fan of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And also joining him, I believe, is my brother Graham from New York City. Now, before we get to you, Graham, let's give the reins to Ben Stark here. Let's not beat around the bush. What's your reaction to Shia LaBeouf's comments, Ben?
Well, first of all, my publicist is giving me index cards with like with notes on them, and I'm apparently skewing too much as the Crystal Skull guy, so I should agree with Shia LaBeouf here. No, I think he's kind of right, and I'm kind of glad that this kind of came out. And I hope there's no backlash, because it doesn't seem like he's being kind of nasty, or he's not dismissing the project. He's just kind of having an open dialogue about it now that, you know, it's made all the money it's going to make. You know, he doesn't have to worry about the studio coming down on him. But yeah, like I said, I agree with kind of what he's saying. I think there's great moments in that movie that I absolutely love. But I can't deny that, culturally, there are some weird, awkward moments that you can kind of see where they're coming from with creatively, where they, you know, what they want to pay homage to, but it just didn't play on screen. And I'm with everybody else on that. The monkey swinging and the shrubbery hitting him in the groin, like doing the splits across two cars. That's just weird stuff that just doesn't, like I said, just doesn't play. And the probably shortchanged special effects doesn't help either.
Well, regardless of what, you know, whether or not you agree with what he's saying, and I'm really kind of concerned, or I would be concerned if I was Shia LaBeouf, about what Mr. Spielberg would think of his comments. And I mean, where do you think, I mean, this is obviously speculation, but where do you think an actor who owes much of his success, and he's had a lot of it, to Spielberg, who single-handedly put him in a position not only to star in that movie, but also be the face, the human face anyway, of the Transformers franchise, and also star in the DJ Caruso films Disturbia and Eagle Eye. I mean, if you're Spielberg, what do you think of these comments?
I think again, because it's not coming from a place of dismissal. I think he's just basically, the one comment that kind of confuses me is where he says, or interests me, is he says, look, the movie could have been updated. So it seems to me that he's just saying that it was just kind of an old fogey idea of action and comedy, maybe. So I think what he's saying is that Spielberg just wasn't in touch with what might entertain a modern audience, which I don't think anybody can disagree with, and I don't think that's necessarily an attack. I think it's good that a young guy who is in tune with our culture is holding Spielberg accountable. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think Spielberg in the past has been openly apologetic about certain projects. And I think he's flat out said that Raiders of the Lost Ark was an apology for 1941, Last Crusade was an apology for Temple of Doom. And I can't remember if this actually was said, but I remember reading this somewhere, even if it's somebody else saying this, but he said Saving Private Ryan was an apology for The Lost World. Now, whether or not I think that he needs to apologize for any of those movies, I don't think that matters. I think what matters is that when Spielberg feels like he's got something to prove, usually a good movie results. He usually comes back nicely, and he doesn't dish a lot in the dirt sheets, from what I understand. He just kind of either accepts it or doesn't accept it, and if he feels like he did something that he needs to own up to, then he'll just kind of prove himself as the great director.
Graham, are you on with us?
I am.
Well, let's get your thoughts.
Well, you know, the general rule of thumb is that you don't air your dirty laundry to the press. It's just a general rule of thumb because, in general, what happens after that isn't ideal. Just look at what happened also this week in kind of a similar situation where Megan Fox, who was in the first two Transformers movies, both produced by Spielberg and both directed by Michael Bay, wasn't picked up for part three by Paramount. And I'm sure Michael Bay had something to do with that decision. Now, a few months ago, or about a year ago, Megan Fox made some public comments that were critical of Michael Bay. And Michael Bay responded in the press saying, you know, haha, whatever, I love Megan, we have an understanding, and we'll see her for part three. Well, didn't work out that way. She's off the project. Now, whether whether her not being on the project is directly related to those comments, you know, you'd be the judge of that. But it kind of seems a little, seems eerily similar to what's going on now with Spielberg and Shia LaBeouf. I don't think Spielberg's going to shed too many tears about this because Indiana Jones and Indiana Jones 4, as I'm just going to call it, made probably close to $800 million worldwide. So that can fund his projects for the next 10 years. So, but you got to be concerned is if something similar to what happened with Megan Fox is going to happen with Shia LaBeouf.
Well, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Indiana Jones 4, like I think most of the people here. I think Ben is pretty much the only one in its camp. But Shia LaBeouf wasn't the primary reason as to why I disliked that movie. I actually thought he added something to the table. Corey, I mean, I think a lot of us are kind of ready to see this franchise just sort of take its final rest, so to speak, especially after that fourth film and what they did with it. I mean, even if they did make another movie, would it bother you if Shia LaBeouf wasn't in it?
Yeah, to be honest, I think it might. Because I think that he was one of the few people involved with the fourth movie who was actually, I mean, despite his self-criticism, engaging the material. I kind of felt like Harrison Ford, apart from glimmers here and there, had essentially checked out. And, you know, I think that Shia LaBeouf was honestly one of the few bright spots about Indiana Jones 4. In spite of the silly nonsense he had to do. I think that if you were to pair them up again and give them, another shot at it, I think that we might have something interesting. Because, to be honest, I like this guy. I don't know why exactly, because I don't really care for any of the films he's made, apart from maybe the first Transformers. But I think he's got a good presence. I think that he added a lot to the fourth Indiana Jones. And I think that, yeah, I'd be down for seeing him try it again, to be honest.
Well, this sort of leads us into a bigger question that I think Shia LaBeouf is sort of in a more veiled way asking, and that we can just kind of ask directly today, and that will lead into our next segment. And Ben and Graham, I'll ask if you're able to, if y'all will stick around for the next few minutes, so we can kind of talk about what Shia LaBeouf is hinting at. So is that cool? Are you guys on board for the next segment?
Yep, sounds good.
Okay, well, everybody stick around. Let's play a little more Vampire Weekend. This is Aspect Radio, and when we come back, we'll start asking the big questions and hopefully giving you some highly speculative, hypothetical answers. Kind of like an episode of Lost, only without the answers, maybe. So stick around.
What's the matter,
Father Pickin'
and
Welcome back to Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft with my co-host Ben Flanagan. We're joined via telephone by Ben Stark and Graham Flanagan. Now, in the last segment, we discussed Shia LaBeouf's recent comments about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and Steven Spielberg. And so this led Ben and I to reflect on the certain list of legendary filmmakers who might still have the touch, might not. Let's talk about this. There are indisputably great directors out there, and we've compiled a nice sized list of them that we're going to discuss. Do they still have it, or do they not?
Yeah, and this is something that I think about every day. it really is, you know, because every year you read, the Entertainment Weekly summer, fall movie preview, that kind of thing, or you look at some website that kind of gives you a rundown of what you're going to see this year. I think Ain't It Cool News probably had the best one that I had read this year that just kind of got me excited about some of the names that I would be seeing and some of the projects that they were attached to. And you see your favorite filmmakers who have new movies coming out. And this is something that still manages to excite me. I'm not totally jaded. If there's a new Scorsese movie out, if there's a new Paul Thomas Anderson movie out, and the list goes on, then I'm excited about it, and my interest completely peaks, and I start researching the project a little bit more. And, you know, sometimes it holds my attention until the movie comes out, until the trailer comes out, and sometimes it kind of loses me. But, you know, every now and then, you'll see one of your favorite filmmakers who's either completely in good form and still young and still at it and still has imaginative ideas, or it's one of the sort of aging filmmakers who was once, you know, considered one of the greatest filmmakers on the planet and still is because they're still alive and they're still working, but you wonder, have they lost that touch? You know, are there movies? Can they stack up against the best work that they've done? And what we're going to do here is we're each going to pick two filmmakers and we're going to make a case for each. Either they still got it or they still don't. And Ben, I'll go ahead and throw you the first turn here, and why don't we go with the directors that don't have it anymore?
Okay. I had to segment mine up, I guess, in a way, because the directors can be defined in different ways, and so I kind of asked myself, well, in three ways, like, who doesn't seem to have it anymore culturally, who doesn't seem to have it anymore technically, and who just do I not personally, who am I not personally enjoying his films anymore, his or her films, as it were. And culturally, I really can't deny that Spielberg and both Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis seem to be missing whatever they had that made them the go-to guys to define the period that they thrived in. If you asked me what suburban life in America was like in the 80s, I'd say, well, just watch E.T. and Back to the Future, and then you'll know. That's basically what it was like. And they don't seem to be as culturally tuned in anymore. That's not to say they're not good filmmakers. That's a different argument. But I think culturally, they've just kind of aged, and I think that's kind of obvious. Technically, I'm kind of staggered by how Brian De Palma isn't able to maintain any kind of tension in Femme Fatale and Mission to Mars. And I haven't even seen a whole lot of old De Palma, but I know that he's kind of renowned as a guy that, you know, knows tension. But especially those two movies, Femme Fatale and Mission to Mars, there's nothing there. And The Black Dahlia, which had this great opening first act, he completely lets the air out of it. And so on a technical level, just as a visual storyteller, I just don't get what he's missing. He seems to not be able to hold it. And the same would be said for John Woo, I think, who's really able to make some really tense action movies in Hong Kong and just hasn't been able to maintain a strong project since then.
Ben, you can't see Corey right now, but, I mean, during your little De Palma spiel there, I mean, this guy was struggling.
You like new De Palma, Corey?
I love The Black Dahlia.
Man, it's a great. It starts off incredibly, and as soon as the murder arises, it all just kind of starts falling apart.
I like Femme Fatale a lot too. I mean, I'm not gonna argue with you about Mission to Mars and his last movie, Redacted, was terrible. But
Femme Fatale is neat, but it's not like a story. You know?
Yeah, that's
It doesn't stick with me. And then as far as his personal preference, Tim Burton and James Cameron are my two picks. I'll pick James Cameron as my overall. It seems like he's this pulp sci-fi storyteller that makes these, you know, really fun rides like Aliens and Terminator 2 and True Lies. But for some reason, with his last two movies, he's felt the need to justify pulp with high drama and melodrama and with Avatar social issues. And I just wish he would just make his pulp sci-fi movies and then let us ascribe our own morality and our own social consciousness to it.
Well, Graham, why don't you make your case for somebody who you think has lost it?
Okay, well, first, I just want to quickly... I stand behind James Cameron. After having watched Avatar a couple of times on Blu-ray, it holds up. And I'm a fan of that film, and I think it's an overall success, despite what anybody wants to say about how cheesy or you know, how he imposes his political and moral beliefs. I stand by that film. It's just unique entertainment. Okay, so somebody who doesn't have it, I don't know if they don't have it anymore, but I'm definitely concerned about Woody Allen. In the wake of Whatever Works last year, which I think is his worst effort maybe of his entire career, that's concerning. And so then he's got a new one coming out in a few months, and we'll see. I've seen one clip, and I'm not sold. It's just a one long single take of Anthony Hopkins talking to a prostitute. It's online. It's from his new film, You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger. But Woody Allen, if you want to talk about technically, I think that he's still trying. He's still trying to stay relevant in that sense, because for Whatever Works, he hired Harris Avidis, who's one of the top five cinematographers in the game. So you can't fault him for that, but it just did not mesh with what I thought was a weak storyline. So I'm concerned about Woody Allen right now, and that's coming from a major Woody Allen disciple, follower, whatever you want to call me, huge fan of his entire body of work.
Well, I think we're all big fans of Woody Allen, and I think it's comforting to look back on 2008. We can go as recent as that, where he had one of my favorite films of his in years, Cassandra's Dream. I know that there are more people who tend to prefer Vicky Cristina Barcelona from that year, but I'm in the minority, I guess. I think Cassandra's Dream is one of his best written movies in years based on dialogue and the suspense that he sort of garners from that. So just being 2 years removed from that, again, is kind of a reassuring thought, don't you think?
Absolutely, but look, I mean, this guy has made a movie every year for like the last 30 years, and in my opinion, only two of those have been what I would call bad. Every single movie other than two I consider to be good, if not great.
And he's approaching
and the
40
other one,
now, right?
What's that?
He's approaching 40 movies now.
42. I think You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger is his 42nd movie.
Well, so out of that, I mean, and to me, Whatever Works and anything else are the only below-average films he's made. And so whenever he makes what I think is a poor film, it's cause for concern because I'm so used to excellence. So it's like, he's raised the bar for himself. He's the only one to blame for that because he's made such quality work. Now, so as a fan, I just hope that with this movie and with his next movie, which also sounds very appealing, Midnight in Paris, that he kind of picks it back up. It's all the element on paper. It sounds like he's got it together, but we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, that's Whatever Works look good on paper. You had Harris Savitas and Larry David in a Woody Allen movie. I mean, that's just how they managed to mess that up. It's baffling.
I do want to talk about his tendency to hire these cinematographers, though, for his later movies, and give them virtually nothing to do, and not really allow them to put a visual trademark on the film. I mean, if you look back at his work with,
Willis?
Yeah, Gordon Willis. If you look back at his work with Gordon Willis, that's so visually distinctive, and yet I feel like this decade, at least, he's been hiring these great cinematographers who have just put out, I want to say, flat work, with the exception of Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which I think is his most visually exceptional movie in decades.
Mm-hmm. And I would say Match Point also looks pretty good.
Yeah, you're right.
I think a lot of that probably has to do with his schedule. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that he gets his movies to be so cheap and so quickly turned around is that his budget is so small because his schedule moves so fast. So if you don't give a cinematographer, even an extremely talented cinematographer, a nice amount of time to really set things up, then you're gonna get a standard, and that's about it. You're not gonna get above average work.
Yeah, and I think that these rushed products and that tend to look good overall, but kind of lack story-wise. I think that they're also kind of a reflection that filmmaking has become sort of a hobby for Woody Allen that keeps him going year to year, less than a passion that it once was. I think he's made the great films that he wants to make, and if he happens to strike gold with one of these movies he makes every year, then he'll probably be satisfied with that. But Corey, I'm very curious as to which director you think has lost it.
I gotta agree with Ben. Tim Burton, in spite of my love
for Sweeney Todd, which I think is one of his best movies, just came out 3 short years ago. Virtually everything else he's done since, I don't know, Mars Attacks, I think.
Yeah, Mars Attacks, I would say.
Yeah, it's unremarkable. Alice in Wonderland represents a career nadir for him. I think that Alice in Wonderland's an awful movie, made with no real imagination and no, you know, nothing but, I suppose, an eye towards marketing, which I don't think you could ever say even about his work in the instantly marketable Batman franchise. I think he's lost it. I think that he is a glorified set designer now, and I'm so upset, you know, saying that. I mean, I can only attribute the success of Sweeney Todd really to the source material.
Well, can I jump in real quick?
Go ahead.
You know, I agree. Alice in Wonderland was a mess, and I didn't really have high expectations based on Tim Burton's recent track record. But look, that movie has made, oh God, close to $1 billion worldwide.
Yeah,
right. So that guarantees Tim Burton creative freedom in the next few years. So even though this movie was a mess, that the fact that it made so much money is going to guarantee him opportunities to, you know, get into the stuff that might not be as commercial, like an Ed Wood or an Edward Scissorhands or other movies that start with Ed.
He hasn't lost money on a movie in a long time. He could have done that a long time ago.
Well, this movie is I think this might be his most successful movie ever.
It is.
More than Batman?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
But you look at worldwide, I think this movie has surpassed $800 million worldwide.
Even domestically, it's grossed over $300 million, has it not? Exactly. And Batman, I don't even... Did it clear $200 million?
Oh, I have no idea.
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay, well, look... while we're on this, let's kind of, as MacGruber would say, go for the turkey here, because Tim Burton is my pick for Lost It as well. And let me kind of jump on my soapbox. And, you know, I actually wrote a column about this not too long ago when Alice in Wonderland came out. If we're rounding off titles, Beetlejuice, Batman, and as you said, Edward Scissorhands, those movies played key roles into sort of introducing what a visionary filmmaker or a striking visual artist with a voice was in terms of what it could be on its own. And, you know, watching a ton of movies that are unrelated to your favorite Saturday morning cartoons at an early age, that might give you kind of a sense of visual style and thematic material that are rooted in specific directors, but it really takes a while to sink in. Tim Burton, I mean, he absolutely changed my perspective in that regard. I mean, watching those films and identifying with visual and thematic motifs, you know, color palettes, practical effects he used, and really the sort of atypical humor, they really influenced my sense of the director's sort of tangible control in general with directors. And I think his sets, his characters, the dark comedy, and the frequent collaborations with guys like Danny Elfman, they really helped me realize and say to myself as I'm watching a movie, that is a Tim Burton movie. I think his was really a voice that sort of inspired the way I watched movies, you know, from that point on. Really, they kind of heightened my anticipation prior to any film he directed. And in 1994, I think Burton delivered his masterpiece, which was Ed Wood. I think it's a hilarious tribute to that filmmaker played by Johnny Depp in what I think is his best performance to date. And with that movie, I felt Tim Burton really kind of escaped that trap of this pigeonholed gimmick in the realm, and he really sort of slipped into the realm of an elite director who is capable of sort of fleshing out a mature work that would be remembered and discussed for years. And I think, sadly, that Burton has never topped or equaled Ed Wood and has seemingly lost whatever distinctive touch he had as a storyteller. And if that sounds harsh, it's only because it really pains me to see a talent like Burton sort of fade away into this series of unoriginal remakes and reimaginations. And Mars Attacks, Sleepy Hollow, Planet of the Apes, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Corpse Bride, and Sweeney Todd, they really only offered faint images of what Burton had come to be. And all he really gives us now are these mainstream misfires that sort of silence this once abnormal voice I grew to love and fear. And I even skipped the latest, Alice in Wonderland, which is something I don't often do with my favorite filmmakers. And I've just reached a point now where I have little to no interest in what he does now. And that's a sad thought.
I'll defend Mars Attacks and Sleepy Hollow. I think those are...
Look, yeah, I mean, there are some merit to those movies. Wood,
Mars Attacks and Big Fish and Sweeney Todd.
Oh, Big Fish is awful.
I like it a lot.
It's awful, Corey.
Sorry.
God,
it's about as good as Femme Fatale.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's worse, Big Fish or Alice in Wonderland. And I think both of those films are really bad.
I realized that this was, like, a controversial opinion. I thought Big Fish was generally well-regarded. Sorry.
One time when I used to work at a bar, this guy knew I was that I was a movie buff, and he asked me what I thought of Big Fish, and I was like, look, I'm sorry. I know it was shot in Alabama and everything, but I thought it was whack. And this guy flipped out on me and was like, you don't know what it's like to have parents if you don't like Big Fish. So that movie struck a chord with a lot of people, but it just made me want to press stop.
Yeah, me too. And look, let's get positive here, because if we talk about Big Fish anymore, it's going to make me angry. So, Ben Stark, let's bring it back to you. I mean, who's a guy that you think still has it?
Well, I think there's a handful of guys I think are in older age but are still doing something that gets a significant reaction out of every project. And Werner Herzog and Sidney Lumet, even though I'm not too familiar with Sidney Lumet's filmography, I still think that both of those guys seem to get a really strong reaction with every one of their movies, and they seem to be doing something new, which is really impressive. But as far as a guy that I think is constantly does great work and measures up to quality, that standard of quality that he set early on, is, and apparently the theme of the show and of my character on the show, is Spielberg. I think he he's not hitting on the cultural vein that he was early on in his career, but I think this decade he made two of my favorite movies, Munich and Minority Report, and then also turned out some really, really good movies that you can just keep on watching and always give you something to enjoy or reflect on. Catch Me If You Can, The Terminal, and War of the Worlds, again, all this decade. And, I mean, you factor that in with Saving Private Ryan, and he's just, the last 10 to 15 years, he's still done great work. I mean, not everybody's a fan of movies like The Lost World or AI or Amistad, but still, I mean, those are capable, strong movies with really nice moments. And like I said, I don't think he's catching on to a cultural thing, but I think he's doing new things. Munich is a completely different kind of movie than he's ever made before. The same goes for Minority Report. And Minority Report especially seems to be aging really well. It's about 8 years old now, and the technology in that seems to be kind of informing a lot of the technology that people are kind of expecting here in the next 10 years.
Right? Oh yeah, without Minority Report, you would not see that commercial for the droid phone.
Right.
And the list goes on.
I think you're right, and I think that the filmmaking in Minority Report and War of the Worlds in particular are Spielberg at the height of his game. You know, I think that is muscular, like, filmmaking right there. That he, I mean, particularly War of the Worlds seems to call back to Jaws, like nothing he's made since then.
Yeah, there's a War of the Worlds, there's a scene in it that's almost a complete remake of the Jurassic Park Raptor kitchen scene, which I think is kind of interesting, but kind of crazy that he would just take from himself, or at least take that idea and kind of add new flavors to it.
Well, Graham, I mean, do you echo any of Ben's sentiments there? Or, I mean, who is your guy?
Listen, real quick on Spielberg, I think that I agree with him in that all of his movies from the last 10 years have just technically been beyond what else was going on in Hollywood at the time. I think technically he has not slowed down. He has just improved and gotten better and better over the years. I just don't think that he improved as much as far as story is concerned. You know, you don't get the level of character and story that you find in Jaws in the movies he's made in the last 10 years, in Minority Report, in War. You know, I think that I'm a fan of Munich. I'm a big fan of The Terminal. But no, they're not the same level of quality of his earlier films. I'm not going to lie. But I think that technically he still is raising the bar, and you got to give him a lot of credit for that.
Well, let me ask you this, Graham, and Ben and Corey, please do chime in. If we're looking at his work as a director from the past decade, and if you look at AI, Minority Report, Catch Me If You Can, The Terminal, War of the Worlds, Munich, and now Indiana Jones 4, think, you know, what if those were his first 8 movies that he had ever made? Well, how would you, you know, it's hard to think of this hypothetically, but I mean, what would you think of him as a filmmaker if, you know, those were his first movies?
I think that, you know, I would think, oh, this must be a pretty talented commercial or music video director that Hollywood has hired to come in and make features that still has a ways to go before he can, you know, really connect with the story and characters.
Yeah.
Wow.
What, Ben, you don't think so?
No, I think I disagree. I think Munich is extremely rich in character, especially just as a character piece of the Avner character. I think it does. I'm not going to say it does it as well as Close Encounters, but I think it deals with obsession in a similarly strong way. And I think Catch Me If You Can, especially, has really, really strong, rich characters and a really rich relationship between the characters. And I think he gets amazing performances out of DiCaprio and Tom Hanks. So I guess I disagree, but I can see where you're coming from. I just disagree.
Well, you know, it hurts me to say this because I still consider Spielberg to be maybe one of my top five favorite filmmakers, but, you know, AI, Catch Me If You Can, and Indiana Jones 4, I consider those to be bad movies. I really do.
AI?
Yeah,
what?
They're just...
Catch
AI
Me If You Can.
AI might be worse than Indy 4.
Why are
me.
You saying that?
I just...
That's not...
It's horrible. The Flesh Fair, I think, is probably the biggest reflection on why that movie just didn't work and was a disaster, where you have a Chris Rock robot show up in the middle of this already bad set piece. I mean, am I wrong here? Were you satisfied with the Chris Rock animatronic that
you're gonna single out the Chris Rock like the 20 seconds?
I think it's just a reflection of I just think it's
a wonderfully like I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's a messy masterpiece, but it's a masterpiece.
I think it's actually Haley Joel Osment's best performance today. I hated him going into it. I didn't like him in The Sixth Sense, but somehow he carried this movie, this idea that I really should... I really think that this was a singular vision that was born in Kubrick's brain, and I think that it's something that only he probably could have pulled off or executed. And I know that he personally handed the reins to Steven Spielberg, but I think it's an idea that should have died with Stanley Kubrick, actually. And it, you know, when I watched that, or when I watched the opening scene of Catch Me If You Can, when you have this "to tell the truth" thing, it makes me want to throw something at the TV. It doesn't feel like a Steven Spielberg experience. You know what I mean? It feels like bad David Fincher these days. And
I think one problem that you're having is that you're expecting a Steven Spielberg experience, and like I said, he's making very different movies than he was making before.
Yeah, he was making good movies before, Ben, and now he's making bad movies, and it is a different experience. So
that's,
I mean,
one thing about AI, Ben.
Sure.
Well, okay, you know, I have a lot of strong feelings about this, and similar to yours, and it was one of the biggest disappointments of my life as a film fan when I saw it. It comes on HBO from time to time, and one nice thing that I can say about that movie is that John Williams was on point in AI.
Yeah. I feel like you guys just, like, took a puppy and put it in front of me and kicked it.
Well, I mean, if this is a puppy, then I wouldn't have any trouble stomping on its head right in front of you, Corey, because, I mean, I think that it's one that deserves it. Maybe it's Rabbit or something.
I would say it's one of his five best movies.
Five best movies.
I don't personally connect with AI, but I can't call it a bad movie, and I certainly can't call Catch Me If You Can a bad movie.
I can't stand it, man. I mean, you know, maybe it's the Boston accents that you hear throughout the movie.
That's
one of my pet peeves. But I just don't think it's really, I don't know, it just doesn't work.
For the next show, we're going to spend 15 minutes excoriating Julianne Moore on 30 Rock.
Yeah, well, let's not go there because I'll get angrier. And we're in the happy part of the segment. So Graham, I mean, who's your guy that still has it?
Well, it's right now, I'm gonna have to say that it's the Coen brothers. Similar in Woody Allen fashion, they're able to rattle off a film every year, and I think that their last three films were just solid, A, grade A efforts, with No Country for Old Men, Bird After Reading, and A Serious Man. And then now, they're working on True Grit, which is being produced by Steven Spielberg, has this great cast, and I read the book, and it's a great property with a lot of potential there, and I think that this, you know, they're going to make a star out of this girl that kind of teams up with Jeff Bridges' Rooster Cogburn. So these guys just, they have it, they have a passion for the story, and that's the key with them, is that everything comes back to the story, that all the technical tricks and all the casting and the music and all the aesthetics of the movie come together to support the story that these guys dreamed up. And I mean, that's, you hear that over and over again, that story is the key. And these guys are just living examples of this fact.
And just a reminder, you are listening to WVUA FM, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, the Capstone. I'm joined by Ben Stark and Grant Flanagan, Corey Kraft, my co-host, as always, week to week. This is Aspect Radio. I feel similarly to the Coen brothers, how I think Ben Stark does to Spielberg. I think that they've sort of, I don't know, I feel like it's kind of like a revamped Coen brothers, where it's not necessarily, you're not tonally getting the same films they were making back in the day when they had this incredible run from the 80s through the 90s, which I think you can stack up to any of the best filmmakers of all time. And visually, or technically, I mean, I think that they're different filmmakers, but they're finding new ways to be great, and I think their last great film, and their best, I think, since maybe The Big Lebowski, is A Serious Man, which came out last year. And, Corey, I know you're a huge fan of the Coen brothers. I mean, have you ever lost it for them?
No. Never once.
Never once.
Never.
Yeah, I'm with Corey. I don't think they lost it, and I think if I defend Spielberg against his past expectations, but I think the best filmmakers alive right now are the Coen brothers.
Yep, absolutely. I can say that without hesitation.
And that's all you have to say about that?
That's right. Okay. I've got my arms crossed in the booth here, nodding my head emphatically. That's
this is basically Corey saying, I'm not going to give in. The Lady Killers is a good movie.
That's right.
Strong, Corey.
It is. It's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
Oh man, you're drunk, man. You're drinking something. I don't know what it is. But again, we're not bashing right now. We're praising. So Corey, who do you praise?
Well, Scorsese doesn't need me to defend him. I really like the works of Francis Ford Coppola this decade. The two movies that he's made. Cronenberg's been really strong, but I think that the filmmaker who probably has seen a slipping in his reputation as of late is Spike Lee, and I think that Spike Lee is still out there doing really, really strong work in spite of a mid-decade misfire with She Hate Me. His last film, Miracle of St. Anna, which came out 2 years ago, was really underrated. I thought a really nice movie. But I think his crowning achievement this decade, I would say 2002's 25th Hour, which is one of the first films to significantly tackle September 11th thematically. It's got probably Edward Norton's best performance ever. The 2006 multi-part HBO documentary, When the Levees Broke, which I think is probably up there with Do the Right Thing as far as Spike Lee films go. It's just a wonderful piece of work.
Yeah, I have yet to see Miracle at St. Anna. I've always wanted to, and I know you've championed it as one of his better movies as of late. And I think you're in the minority there, too. Like you said, his reputation as a filmmaker has sort of seen kind of a decline. But, Graham, I know that you're a huge fan of When the Levees Broke, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean,
I think it's stronger at the beginning. I mean, when he is kind of just breaking down step by step how Katrina happened, and what happened in the immediate aftermath, I mean, it is so compelling and so well done. You know, just shows you that he is a great documentary filmmaker. But then in the second half, it becomes kind of a lot of talking heads, a lot of crying and whining, and I understand they're all justified, but it's not as strong as the first act.
Well, I'm a big fan of Spike Lee too. We can easily go back and look at his earlier movies, which is kind of the point of this discussion. My favorite movie, I think, during the second half of his career, you might say, is actually He Got Game, and that was in 1998. I still love that movie very much. That was 12 years ago, and I do like When the Levees Broke, and The 25th Hour. Certainly. Raises a lot of interesting questions and is good visually, and I think a lot of people regard that as one of the best films of the decade. And Ben Stark, I don't know that I've ever discussed Spike Lee with you. I mean, do you have any general thoughts?
Despite being a disciple of Aaron Greer, I've only seen Inside Man.
Disciple of Aaron Greer. That's the only Spike Lee movie you've ever seen?
I think so. I don't know.
No Malcolm X, no Do the Right Thing, no...
No.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, get on that.
Man. Hit the Netflix queue.
To everybody.
Yeah, well, let me jump right in. look, Corey already mentioned him, and I'll just say The Departed isn't the kinetic gangster epic that Goodfellas once was, and Shine a Light isn't the hard-rocking, nostalgic rock doc that The Last Waltz was, and The Aviator most definitely is not the sprawling, operatic, and highly tragic biopic that Raging Bull was, and nor will they ever will be. But you knew that, and like me, because they're serviceable in a way that's neither insulting or, you know, not enough, or enough for me to sort of let denial justify my continuing affinity for a master like Martin Scorsese, and not since 1995's Casino have I really felt like I was part of something special when Scorsese was at the helm. He came close once or twice with his typical usage of like whip pans and rock soundtracks and inspired editing, thanks in part to longtime collaborator Thelma Schoonmaker, who he still works with today. But the Scorsese we previously knew as this relentless and violent storyteller, he had aged in to a still-spirited lover of film, and at least he could still grab our attention, even if that was only half as thrilling. And we'd never get another King of Comedy, but we'd have that forever, and along with Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, films that would help erase the mediocrity of Gangs of New York or Bringing Out the Dead, these sort of dull remnants of a once great director who made us wonder what else they could do with a camera. But then something like Shutter Island shows up and packs the kind of wallop that really threatens us for thinking the old man ever lost it. And sometimes it just takes the right story, sometimes just one book in this case. Then the juices get flowing again, and this director will begin to tell stories like he once did, and really like he never has. And with Shutter Island, it felt like a completely new Martin Scorsese experience. It felt like he was growing as a storyteller and a filmmaker again, and really, to me, nothing feels better than that.
Yeah,
I hope the good.
Oh, I was gonna say, I mean, I love his work this decade, with possible exception of Gangs of New York, which I think is good. But I would actually say that The Aviator, and we've had this discussion many times, but I love The Aviator, and I think it's just as vital to his filmography as anything else he's ever done. But you're right that Shutter Island feels like Scorsese invigorated, and it's a wonderful piece of work.
Yeah, I think this decade has seen him become just a really good studio director, and I think that's kind of, I don't know if I necessarily prefer his work now, but I might, because I think he's just become this really good plot guy, that he has strong characters, but he just lets the plot carry on, and when you combine a really good plot with a visionary director, you get really good movies, and I think in his other masterpieces, it was all more character-based, more atmosphere-based, and kind of episodic. But these past couple of movies, especially The Departed and Shutter Island, have just been like really good kind of potboilers. And I think he's having fun, and that comes across in the work.
I think that I agree. I think maybe Shutter Island is the best film of 2010 so far. I really hope that it can that the studio can keep it alive come awards time, because I think that it should be up. Not only that, there are a lot of actors that should be on the short list for that movie: DiCaprio, Patricia Clarkson, Ben Kingsley, Mark Ruffalo, and the guy that played the warden who has that one scene in the Jeep should all be awards contenders come next year. But I think hopefully too the art direction for that movie will be recognized, because man, they created a world that became real. That still sticks with me, and they did it all with sets and camera work and special effects, and just totally succeeded in creating that world that you never want to go back to. So I agree. I think you saw a resurgence with Scorsese in Shutter Island, and regarding The Aviator, I thought it was good. I'd give it like a B+, but I thought it was interesting when Glenn Kenney was on the show a couple months ago. He said that watching The Aviator on Blu-ray was just this like life-changing experience, and I have yet to do that, so I definitely want to check that out and see it again for its visual merits.
Oh, it's great looking on Blu-ray. Yeah. And speaking of the merits of Shutter Island, I feel like I should also note that Robert Richardson needs to win the Best Cinematography Oscar for this movie, because I don't see anything coming out that would top this visually. Obviously, one of Martin Scorsese's merits as a filmmaker is his deep knowledge of well, other filmmakers, and particularly the works of Powell and Pressburger. And Robert Richardson's cinematography here really evokes like Black Narcissus and The Red Shoes and all of those great Powell Pressburger Technicolor works in such a way that, like, it's shocking if you see Black Narcissus to observe how similar they look and how great that sort of matchup is.
Well, you know, I think this has been healthy to kind of look back on our favorites and just kind of break it down, hold a mirror up to ourselves as film lovers, and, you know, admit to whether or not our favorite directors have still got it or whether they still have it. And I mean, just to kind of give the listeners our unofficial list of still greats or has-beens, this list that I was choosing from, and it sounds like you guys were as well. I'll just go ahead and read the names so you can kind of decide for yourself. Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Clint Eastwood, Woody Allen, Francis Ford Coppola, Roman Polanski, David Cronenberg, Jean-Luc Godard, Werner Herzog, Sidney Lumet, Oliver Stone, Bernardo Bertolucci, Spike Lee, Tim Burton, David Lynch, Robert Zemeckis, the Coen brothers, Mike Nichols, and Brian De Palma, these still active, either legendary or highly reputable filmmakers who are still generating new films. And I'm sure there are more out there that we're probably forgetting. But I do want to thank Graham and Ben Stark for joining us from Huntsville and, I believe, Connecticut today. I appreciate your thoughts.
Can I jump in real quick, Ben? Yeah. Before we go, it sounds like that there's a consensus between me, Ben Stark, and Corey that the Coen brothers are the best directors working today. And I'm going to exclude Paul Thomas Anderson from this conversation since he only makes a movie every, like, 5 years now. When I say best working directors, do you agree that the Coen brothers are the best filmmakers, working filmmakers today?
I think I would, you know, I've been burned by them a few times this decade, just in terms of, you know, obviously The Lady Killers. I'm not a huge fan of Burn After Reading either. I like it, but I just don't think it's their best work. I think I might stick with Steven Soderbergh as the best active filmmaker.
He's a good backup.
Yeah, that's
a good backup. Come on. But no, I do think that they're right there. They're neck and neck. But I think I just kind of prefer what he's doing. I think that the Coen brothers were the last ones to make a great movie. I think A Serious Man is better than Soderbergh's best efforts in the past few years.
And I'd stack up The Lady Killers favorably against
okay,
the good
this
German.
This segment is over. but again, thank you, Graham and Ben, for joining us via telephone, and hopefully you guys will come back.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
All right, well, Corey, let's take a very quick break because we're well into the 10 o'clock hour. When we come back, we're actually not quite done with this topic. Our friend Matt Scalici is actually going to give his 2 cents, which will take just a couple of minutes, and then we'll offer up our DVD picks. But I'm kind of liking our little theme here, so come back to Aspect Radio. We just have a few minutes to go.
Aspect Radio listeners, this is Matt Scalici, and I've been asked by your gracious hosts to give you my thoughts on this very interesting topic of great directors either losing it or hanging on to it, I guess. This is a discussion that I've had many times over the past few years with my colleagues here, particularly Mr. Stark, and it's something that I think really touches on a fundamental aspect of not just film, but all art, and that's the issue of what's more important, what's being said, or who's saying it. And I think we all agree that seeing a certain director's name in the opening credits of a film does have an effect on how you perceive that film, and that's not something we can really control. And I think that might be the case for me with Woody Allen. I discovered Woody Allen when I was a sophomore in college and proceeded to watch every film he'd ever made in chronological order. It's just a thing I do. It took me about a year to do that. And obviously, I love Woody Allen. I love his movies. I think he has a very unique sensibility as a filmmaker, and I particularly love his dramatic films. I think he's one of the best dramatic filmmakers still working today, certainly over the past 30 years. But when we're talking about, you know, this particular topic, I think what's most important here are the 10 films that Woody Allen made in the last decade. He made one a year for the last 10 years. And I think that's what's important to look at when we're discussing whether he still got it or not. Started off with a couple of sort of clever comedy capers, I guess, Small Time Crooks and Curse of the Jade Scorpion. Then he had a very pedestrian couple of movies with Hollywood ending and anything else. And then it's at that point that I really think Allen started to rediscover it, that thing that made him a great director back in the early part of his career. He comes out with Melinda and Melinda, which is a very interesting, very unique idea for a film, and then puts out what a lot of people would call his modern classic, Match Point, which I think is certainly up there in the upper echelon of his catalog. And Cassandra's Dream and Vicky Cristina Barcelona are also both really, really excellent films, really stack up with almost anything he's ever done. And, you know, is it the Woody Allen of the 80s? No, but in my opinion, he made better movies in this past decade than he did in the 90s. And to me, that's a sign that he's not slowing down, and he's still got whatever it was that made him a special director early on in his career. Steven Spielberg, on the other hand, still in his mid-60s. He's a younger guy than Woody Allen, but I think we saw his career take a much different trajectory last decade. He opened the decade with perhaps the most ambitious project of his career, AI, a project that I think even hardcore Spielberg fans will admit fell flat on its face. And then he came out with both Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can in 2002, movies that were, you know, good, solid entertainment, but I don't think they really feel as significant as the rest of Spielberg's work. There's just something missing from those that the great Spielberg films seem to have. You know, and I still really haven't figured out what he was trying to do when he made The Terminal. I mean, it's largely just light fluff, and really is a very insignificant film in comparison to the rest of his catalog. I guess what really disappoints me the most about Spielberg's films in the last 10 years is just the overwhelming pessimism that seems to be pervading his work now. You know, I think we really started to see that with War of the Worlds, which is just a, you know, to me it was a joyless experience. It's filled with 9/11 imagery, and that just felt really inappropriate in a summer blockbuster like that. Munich, obviously, I thought was a pretty thoughtful movie and well made, certainly, but again, it's really leaves you feeling emotionally hollow in a way that, you know, you just don't come to expect that from Spielberg based on his past work. And I guess it's hard to call, you know, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull anything other than, you know, again, joyless. It wasn't a movie that felt like it was being made with joy. It wasn't really being made for any reason other than the pure commercial opportunity that was there. You know, but I think it's that lack of optimism that makes me say that Spielberg doesn't have it anymore, because I think that's what it was for him early on in his career. It was that his films made us feel childlike again. They made us feel that sort of just, you know, incredible optimism of our youthful days, and I don't think his films have that anymore. And I, you know, hopefully we'll see that again in one of his films, but I worry that it might be gone from Steven Spielberg. That's it for me, guys.
You're just hurting yourself with this rambunctious behavior.
Money point seven.
And here we are again. We got the hot mic from last week popped up for this to close us out. And closing the book on, I guess, that discussion that we were having in the last segment was our friend Matt Scalici from FilmNerds.com. And his choices, Woody Allen still has it. Spielberg has lost it. And I was looking through this glass window that Corey and I share here, and he was unimpressed, I think, with some of the things that Matt was saying about Steven Spielberg. And Ben Stark is actually going to join us for our DVD picks. And Ben, let's not overreact to some of the things that Matt was saying there.
Oh, I was expecting that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Corey, I'll let you go ahead and let's quickly round off our DVD picks. This is Craft Services.
Well, if you haven't seen it, you now have the opportunity to check out The Messenger, the Academy Award-nominated film from last year, starring Ben Foster and Oscar nominee Woody Harrelson, about two Army notification officials who go to families of dead servicemen to inform them of the bad news. And that Ben Foster's character eventually falls in love or has a weird connection with a widow played by Samantha Morton.
I don't think it entirely works, but Woody Harrelson is so good, and it's very raw and emotional and definitely worth seeing if you haven't yet. Next week, you finally have the opportunity to see John Hillcoat's adaptation of The Road, which comes out on DVD and Blu-ray on Tuesday. Another very good, though not quite great, film, an adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. The novel's wonderful. The movie is probably as good as an adaptation of that novel could ever be, because so much of that book's power comes from Cormac McCarthy's prose. It seems kind of pointless to literalize it in film, but there you go. It's a famous book, and somebody figured they could make some money off of a movie.
Well, I haven't seen either of those films, and I really look forward to finally seeing both of them. I was looking forward to The Road a little more going into the fall season, but The Messenger certainly caught my attention. Ben Foster is really a guy that I've had my eye on. I think he's done a lot of great work, even in the highly mediocre movie Alpha Dog. He was really kind of the bright spot in that movie. But Ben, do you have any picks?
Hostage, great Ben Foster movie.
Yeah, that's actually, I actually agree with that. That's,
oh my god, really?
Yeah.
I'll keep going here. My wife and I took a little vacation. We went to the beach last week, and we had cable, which we don't usually have. I think it's kind of a distraction, but I caught some movies on TV, which I never do. And we also got Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs on DVD, which was hilarious, a lot funnier than I thought it was going to be, and really just a really nice modern comedy, but still smart enough to it uses the not the most mainstream comedic talents, I guess, with Bill Hader and Andy Samberg in there. Just really funny. I also finally caught Transporter 3. So, you know.
What, did you watch that on FX or something?
Hey, I think it was on Stars or something like that. So instead of catching up on my Spike Lee on When the Levees Broke, I decided to catch Transporter 3, which is the best in the series,
God.
In case you're wondering.
I like how you say you finally saw Transporter 3.
It's been on the list. But no, it's a nice diversion. The first two are kind of fun, but pretty trashy overall. But I think the third one takes all the good stuff from the first two and then just kind of amps it up and makes it better. I'm very self-conscious right now. And then I also recently finally caught up with The Last Picture Show, a legitimate finally caught up with, which is a fantastic movie. And I think it's still available on Instant Watch on Netflix. And it's just a really nice show of who Bogdanovich, or what Bogdanovich could do early on after he did Targets, which is also a very good movie, but a very different movie.
Yeah, justified hype, I think, with The Last Picture Show. Just a really nice display of subtle tragedy and just beautiful cinematography, black and white cinematography, and a really hot Sybil Shepherd in her early days.
And I think it's a productive view of decay. I think a lot of times decay is a motif that a lot of filmmakers use in almost a lazy way and just let it say all it needs to by itself, which usually just becomes a case in depression and just kind of just making a very morose project. But I think The Last Picture Show, I think, deals with it in a very intelligent and organic way.
Well, and if you haven't thrown it on your list yet or not seen it, you should watch Paper Moon next, which is another great Bogdanovich movie, and a great performance from Tatum O'Neill and her father, Ryan O'Neill. Great stuff. If you see any drool stains on my shirt, it's because I just recently got Toy Story on Blu-ray from Netflix.
Nice.
And I haven't watched it from beginning to end yet. You know, I've seen the movie, obviously, but I just sampled it the other night. I just I went to the chapter where the toys all come out for the first time, and my jaw absolutely dropped. I mean, it is so gorgeous on Blu-ray. And this is, you know, again, one of the first Blu-ray movies that I've seen since I got the player. But I cannot wait to get back and watch this movie on a big, you know, flat screen with the Blu-ray player. It is absolutely gorgeous, I'll just say again. So Toy Story, that's what I'll be watching this weekend, maybe more than once. And I might just go ahead and pop Toy Story 2 in, getting ready for Toy Story 3 this summer. So that's it for me. We're making announcements now, opening nationwide and in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16, MacGruber, which we discussed today with Will Forte, Kristen Wiig, and Val Kilmer. Shrek Forever After with Mike Myers, Eddie Murphy, and Cameron Diaz. That's going to be in 3D and 2D. The Bollywood romance Kites is in Tuscaloosa. And a documentary called Racing Dreams. So two, unusual picks from the Cobb Hollywood 16. But, you know, they're known for that at this point. Also, keep an eye out for the Bama Art House Summer Movie Series, which opens with Noah Baumbach's comedy Greenberg playing June 8th at 8 p.m. at the Bama Theater.
And if you have any feedback, you can email us at 90.7movies@gmail.com. If you feel we've missed something or you have any suggestions as to films we can review or topics we can discuss, please do email us. You can also follow us on Twitter at Aspect Radio or twitter.com/Aspect Radio. We might even read a comment or two on the air, so keep them coming.
Yeah, and Ben, thank you again for joining us. Please do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and we will podcast this and other episodes of the show. You can find those on our blog at aspectradio.tumblr.com, Tumblr spelled T-U-M-B-L-R. We will post the podcast on Twitter and Facebook as well. And you can catch Maya and Corey's columns in Tusk Magazine, found in every Friday edition of the Tuscaloosa News. For Corey Kraft, I'm Ben Flanagan. Ben Stark, thanks again for joining us. Thanks for listening.